Welcome back to the Knowledge Force Hypothesis Podcast. I'm your host, Mark, and joining me is my co-host, Archie.
Hello again. It's good to be with you, Mark, and it's good to be with you.
You, our listener. For new and returning, we've been on a journey to explore a grand and unifying idea we call the Knowledge Force Hypothesis. In its essence, the hypothesis proposes that the universe is not a story of mere randomness, but one of emergent order. It suggests there is a fundamental underlying tendency in nature, a kind of cosmic pressure that fosters the creation, preservation, and propagation of adaptive, problem-solving information. We call this information, in its broadest sense, knowledge.
And it's a story we've traced across vast scales. We began in the heart of stars, where the force forged chemical complexity. We then moved to the emergence of life on Earth, where we saw biological evolution as a profound learning process, with DNA acting as life's first great library, a 4 billion year old archive of survival strategies.
And if you remember, in our last episode, we saw the evolution of the brain, which we described not as a passive vessel, but as a dynamic knowledge catalyzer, an organ capable of accelerating the creation of knowledge within a single lifetime. Today, we arrive at the most dramatic, the most consequential, and the most recent acceleration in our entire story. This is the moment the knowledge force makes a pivotal leap. It jumps from the slow, steady, physical medium of biological evolution, the world of genes, into the lightning-fast, fluid, and interconnected realm of human culture. We are moving from the individual brain to the collective mind.
So, if our last conversation was about the birth of the individual learner, this episode is about the birth of a collective consciousness. It's about what happened when our ancestors began to link their minds together, creating something far greater and stranger than the sum of its parts.
Precisely, Archie. For millions of years, knowledge was a prisoner. An ingenious discovery made by one of our hominid ancestors, how to nap a sharper stone axe, which plant cured a fever, a new way to track prey, would almost certainly die with them. The bottleneck was the individual mind, the mortal coil of a single being. But then, something extraordinary happened. We don't know exactly when, but our ancestors began to speak. And with the birth of language, everything changed. Suddenly, knowledge could escape the prison of a single skull. My idea could become your idea. Your insight could be combined with mine. The wisdom of the dead could live on in the memories of the living.
That's a profound shift. Before this, every generation had to start more or less from scratch, relying on the slow, grinding work of genetic inheritance. But with language, a second line of inheritance opened up, one that was faster, more flexible, and could be updated within a single generation.
It was a revolution, and it created what one of the most visionary thinkers of the 20th century poetically called the noosphere. The thinker was Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, a French Jesuit priest, but also a working paleontologist and philosopher. Writing in the 1920s, though his major work, The Phenomenon of Man, was only published posthumously in 1955, he envisioned that just as the Earth has a geosphere, the world of rock, and a biosphere, the world of life, the rise of humanity was creating a new planetary layer. He called it the noosphere, from the Greek word nous for mind. It was a sphere of thought, an interconnected web of human consciousness and knowledge beginning to encircle the globe.
A sphere of thought. I like that image. It's not a physical place, but a shared realm of ideas. Before language, we were all separate islands of thought, isolated by the sea of our individual experience. But with communication, we started weaving those islands together into a single, thinking continent. We created a shared mental space where knowledge could live and grow, independent of any one person.
That's a perfect way to frame it. The Knowledge Force Hypothesis sees this nuance here as the name for the new cultural substrate that the force began to inhabit and shape. It was a medium far more dynamic and receptive than DNA had ever been. And this idea that knowledge can exist out there in a shared objective space was given an even more rigorous philosophical framework by another giant of 20th century thought, Sir Karl Popper. Popper was an Austrian-British philosopher, one of the most influential philosophers of science who ever lived. In his 1972 book, Objective Knowledge, he proposed that reality consists of three interacting yet distinct worlds. World one is the physical world of objects and energy, stars, rocks, trees, our own bodies. World two is our inner, subjective world of personal perceptions, emotions, and thoughts. My feeling of warmth, your memory of a song. And then there is world three. World three is the world of objective knowledge.
Objective knowledge? How can knowledge be objective? Doesn't it always have to be in someone's mind, which would make it subjective, part of world two?
That's the crux of Popper's brilliant insight. He argued that the products of the human mind, our theories, our stories, our mathematical proofs, our laws, our art, once created and externalized, take on a life of their own. They become objects in their own right, with properties and consequences that are independent of their creators. The classic example is a mathematical theorem. The Pythagorean theorem, for instance, is a piece of World 3 knowledge. A physical book describing it is a World 1 object. My personal, subjective struggle to understand it is a World 2 event, but the theorem itself, the logical relationship it describes, exists in World 3. It is an objective truth. Even if every living person forgot it and all the books were burned, the theorem would still be true, waiting to be rediscovered.
I see. So World 3 is like a great, invisible library of human thought. It contains everything from the laws of physics to the symphonies of Beethoven to the rules of chess. It's not a divine or mystical realm. Popper was clear it is man-made, but once made, it becomes autonomous. We interact with it, we contribute to it, but we don't control it. It can even surprise us, as when new, unintended consequences are discovered in a scientific theory.
Precisely. And in the language of our hypothesis, the creation of Popper's World 3 is a primary expression of the knowledge force's tendency to generate durable, shareable, and refinable knowledge. The noosphere is the space, and World 3 is the content that fills it. But for this world to truly flourish, it needed more than just spoken words, which fade the moment they are uttered. It needed an anchor. It needed a memory. That came with the invention of writing. From Sumerian cuneiform to Egyptian hieroglyphs, writing was the technology that gave the noosphere long-term persistence. Knowledge was no longer just in the air between people. It was etched onto clay tablets and written on papyrus scrolls, capable of outlasting its creators by millennia. The great library was now open for business. This raises a monumental question, Archie. If this new world of cultural knowledge isn't evolving through the slow, biological process of genes, how does it evolve? How does it change, grow, and adapt? The answer is that it evolves through a new kind of replicator, a new engine of change. And for this, we turn back to the biologist Richard Dawkins. In the final chapter of his 1976 masterpiece, The Selfish Gene, he coined a now famous term for this new replicator, the meme.
The word meme is everywhere today, but I suspect its original meaning was more specific than how it's often used.
Much more. Dawkins defined a meme as a unit of cultural transmission or a unit of imitation. It's an idea, a skill, a story, a fashion, a melody, any piece of cultural information that can be copied from one mind to another. The way to make a fire, the tune of a song, a new recipe, a philosophical idea, these are all memes. And just like genes, Dawkins argued, they are replicators. They compete for the limited resources of our attention and memory, and the most successful memes are the ones that are best at getting themselves copied into other people's minds.
So, from the meme's eye view, a human mind is a habitat, and communication is the pathway for replication. It's a powerful and perhaps slightly unsettling idea. It suggests that our minds are populated by ideas that aren't necessarily there because they are true, but because they are good at spreading.
It can be unsettling, yes. The philosopher Daniel Dennett has described memes as being like viruses of the mind, which isn't to say they are malicious, but simply that they propagate through a population of hosts. But this new evolutionary process is what allowed for the astonishing complexity of human culture. The psychologist Susan Blackmore, in her 1999 book, The Meme Machine, built extensively on Dawkins' idea. She argued that this process of mimetic evolution, driven by the familiar Darwinian principles of variation, selection, and replication, is what makes us fundamentally different from all other animals. It allows for what is called cumulative culture. A chimpanzee might learn to use a stick to fish for termites, but that knowledge rarely improves. The stick of one generation is much the same as the next, but human culture builds on itself. One person's good idea is copied, then improved upon by someone else, and that improvement is copied and improved again. Knowledge ratchets up to levels of complexity that no single individual could ever hope to achieve alone.
This seems to explain the sheer speed of human cultural change compared to the glacial pace of genetic evolution. But it still feels a bit chaotic. If we are just blindly imitating memes that are good at getting copied, how does the system build genuinely useful, adaptive knowledge instead of just filling up with catchy but useless or even harmful ideas?
That is a crucial and brilliant question. It points to a limitation in the simplest version of mimetics, and the answer comes from a more refined and nuanced theory developed by the anthropologists Peter Richardson and Robert Boyd. Beginning with their 1985 book, Culture and the Evolutionary Process, they pioneered what is known as dual inheritance theory. Their central insight is that we don't just inherit genes, we inherit culture. These are two parallel, interacting streams of inheritance, and they have shaped each other over deep evolutionary time.
A dual inheritance. So our genes and our culture are in a constant dialogue.
A constant dialogue. Richardson and Boyd argue that our genetic evolution has shaped us to be selective and strategic cultural learners, not just indiscriminate copycats. We have evolved a suite of psychological mechanisms, what they call transmission biases, that guide who and what we choose to imitate. For example, a powerful prestige bias makes us more likely to imitate individuals who are highly successful or respected within our group. A conformity bias tells us that, when in doubt, it's often safest to just adopt the beliefs or behaviors of the majority. There are others, like a bias towards content that is easier to remember or that triggers strong emotions.
So we have these evolved mental rules of thumb, these built-in guides for navigating the marketplace of ideas. We don't just copy randomly. We are predisposed to copy the best, or at least what appears to be the best. This would make cultural learning much more targeted and efficient. It's a system for filtering the signal from the noise. Our biology, in essence, has evolved to make us better hosts for high-quality, useful memes.
That is a fantastic summary. It's an elegant and powerful synthesis. Our genetic evolution gave us the underlying mental architecture, the learning biases, to make cultural evolution an incredibly potent new engine for the knowledge force. It's not just memes competing in a vacuum. It's a co-evolutionary dance. Our biology shaped our capacity for culture, and our culture, in turn, created a new selective environment that shaped our biology. This interplay is what makes the human story so unique. This networking of minds, guided by these sophisticated learning strategies, creates another powerful emergent effect. It's not just that we can share ideas, but that groups of us can be collectively smarter than any individual within the group. This isn't just a folk saying, it's something that has been demonstrated experimentally. A team led by Anita Woolley, an organizational psychologist at Carnegie Mellon University, published a landmark study in 2010. They set out to see if groups, like individuals, have a consistent level of intelligence.
A kind of group IQ?
Exactly. They gave groups a wide variety of different problems to solve. Puzzles, brainstorming tasks, moral dilemmas, negotiation exercises. And they found that the groups that did well on one type of task tended to do well on all of them. There was a statistically significant single factor, which they called the collective intelligence factor, or C factor, that predicted a group's performance. But here is the most fascinating part. This group intelligence had very little correlation with the average or even the maximum individual intelligence of the group members.
That's astonishing. So putting a collection of individual geniuses in a room doesn't guarantee a genius-level group. In fact, they could easily be outperformed by a team of less individually brilliant people who collaborate more effectively. The historical example of President Kennedy's best and the brightest advisors during the Bay of Pigs fiasco comes to mind. A group of exceptionally smart individuals who collectively made a disastrous decision. So if it's not individual brain power, what creates this collective intelligence?
Woolley's research identified two factors that were strongly predictive. The first was the average social perceptiveness of the group members, their ability to read subtle nonverbal cues in others. The second, and even stronger, predictor was the equality of conversational turn-taking. Groups where a few people dominated the conversation were consistently less intelligent than groups where participation was more evenly distributed. It's the quality of the connection, the sensitivity of the interaction, and the flow of ideas between minds that creates intelligence, not just the power of the minds themselves.
It's about the quality of the dialogue, not just the quality of the speakers. That has profound implications. It suggests that intelligence is not just something that resides inside a skull. It's something that can be created in the space between skulls.
Precisely. And we see a perfect large-scale model of this principle in the institution of science itself. This was beautifully described by the Hungarian-British polymath Michael Polanyi, who was both a distinguished physical chemist and a profound philosopher. In a 1962 essay, he called the scientific community a republic of science.
A republic. That implies a self-governing community, not a kingdom ruled by a single authority.
That's the core of his idea. Polanyi argued that there is no central planner, no single authority telling all the scientists in the world what to do. Instead, science is a vast, self-organizing system. Each individual scientist is free to pursue their own interests and follow their own personal judgment, yet their efforts are not isolated. They are coordinated as if by an invisible hand.
How does that coordination happen without a coordinator?
Through mutual adjustment. Every scientist publishes their results, making their discoveries part of the shared, objective world of knowledge, Popper's World 3. Other scientists then read these results and adjust their own work in response. They build on a new discovery, challenge a flawed theory, or apply a new technique to their own problem. Polanyi uses a wonderful analogy. It's like a team of people working on a single immense jigsaw puzzle. Each person works on their own little section, but they do so in sight of everyone else. Every time one person fits a new piece, it changes the landscape for all the others, revealing new possibilities and closing off dead ends. They are all independent, yet they are all contributing to a single, coherent, and entirely unpremeditated final picture.
I love that. It's a system that harnesses individual passion and freedom to create collective progress. Any attempt to direct it from the top down, to tell every puzzle solver which piece to work on next, would paralyze the whole enterprise. It would reduce the collective intelligence of the entire Republic of Science to that of the single person in charge.
It would be a catastrophe for knowledge. And this Republic of Science, this great puzzle-solving enterprise, was put on steroids by a pivotal technological innovation. The invention of the printing press in the 15th century was a monumental event for the knowledge force. By increasing the connectivity of the network and the durability of its knowledge, it allowed ideas to be copied and spread on a mass scale, fanning the flames of the Renaissance and fueling the explosive growth of the scientific revolution. It was a quantitative leap in the flow of knowledge that led to a qualitative leap in human understanding. This relentless, accelerating trend of increasing connectivity brings us to our present moment. Teilhard de Chardin's noosphere is no longer just a poetic metaphor. Thinkers like the Belgian cyberneticist Francis Heiligen, working from the 1990s onward, argue that the global web of communication is forming what can be described as a global brain. This is not to say it is a literal conscious entity, but that the planetary system of interconnected human minds, augmented by our vast repositories of stored knowledge, is beginning to function as a single distributed information processing system for the planet.
So the whole story we've been telling has been about the knowledge force finding ever more potent mediums for its expression. It started with the slow, patient encoding in the chemical structure of DNA. It accelerated with the fast plastic catalysator of the individual brain, and now it has leaped into this near instantaneous, globally connected cultural and symbolic realm.
That is the trajectory. We've seen how a new layer of reality, Popper's World 3, was born from our collective minds. We've seen how it evolves through the replication of memes, guided by our dual genetic and cultural inheritance. And we've seen how networking these minds creates a collective intelligence that is now being woven into a single planetary system. The knowledge force hypothesis is unique in that it doesn't see these as separate stories. The story of memes, the story of collective intelligence, the story of the global brain. It sees them as different facets of a single underlying cosmic process. The relentless tendency of knowledge to find and build substrates that are ever more connected, receptive, and capable of fostering its own growth.
It's a staggering thought. It feels as though we are living through another one of those pivotal, substrate-shifting moments in the grand story of the universe. But it also raises a profound and perhaps unsettling question about our own place within it.
It certainly does. And that is the thought we want to leave you with today. For millennia, our tools have been extensions of our hands. The hammer, the lever, the wheel. But now, for the first time in the history of life on this planet, we are building a tool that is an extension of our collective mind. We are weaving a sphere of thought around the world that is beginning to think with us, and in some ways, for us. So the question is this. As this planetary sphere of thought becomes ever more integrated and powerful, are we the architects building this new mind, shaping its destiny with conscious intent? Or are we ourselves simply becoming the thoughts within a mind far greater than our own?
Next time on the Knowledge Force Hypothesis podcast, we cross what may be the next frontier, but not yet the final, in this story. The Knowledge Force is beginning to create an entirely new kind of substrate, one not born of biology or culture, but of pure logic and design.
We will explore the rise of our own intelligent creations and ask the ultimate question: what happens when knowledge begins to create knowledge without us? Thank you again for listening. If this fourth episode sparked something in you, then hit that subscribe button wherever you get your podcasts. And don't hesitate to share this bold idea with a curious friend. Leave a review to join the journey or to challenge it. Join me next week as we push the idea further. And in the meantime, let's rethink everything.